So just allowing yourself to come back into this circle. And as you do, again, just letting yourself tune into the body, seeing if there's any little adjustments that need to be made. Maybe you need to grab a pillow or just change your posture a little bit. We often will talk about the meditation posture as one that's this sort of combination of upright, dignified, alert, but also at ease and relaxed. And one of the things that we had the great opportunity to do in our practice is to really notice what the energy is like in our own body, in our own mind, and move in one direction or the other, depending on where we're at. So if today you're feeling maybe very sluggish, sometimes it can be helpful to bring in a little bit more of that upright, energetic quality. If you're feeling in pain or depleted, or maybe even anxious, sometimes it can actually be great to lay on the floor and really feel the gravity, the holding of the earth. So I really invite you to play with that a little bit. So you can close your eyes when you're ready. And just feeling your body making contact with the surface beneath you. And just noticing those places where your body makes contact with the chair or the couch. Contact of your maybe hands resting in the lap. Even the contact of the eyelids touching each other or the lips making contact with one another as you rest here with eyes closed. Mouth relaxed. So often in our life, we kind of barrel into whatever the next thing is. But when we're practicing here together, we can take our time to transition and to intentionally and comfortably flow into practicing. As you sit here, you might notice that there are places in the body that are a little bit tight. Maybe they habitually hold tension. You can just take a moment to invite them very subtly, very gently. Nothing needing to be forced, just inviting those places of holding to ease up or relax or soften. Can often help in this sort of a moment to really intentionally relax muscles around the eyes. Relaxing the tongue. Letting the muscles in the jaw soften. You might notice as you let these muscles release and relax that there's a little bit of a ripple effect that just flows down the rest of the body. And I invite you to even bring your breath into this a little bit, imagining or sensing the way that every breath you take, every exhale, you could just invite a little more ease into the body. Because the more ease we can invite into the body, the more receptive, the more open, the clearer our mind heart can become. Just like you might stretch before going on a run. When we bring some ease, some malleability, some openness, some space into our body, we're preparing the grounds for the mind and heart to follow. As you let that body settle, you might notice that there's a little stretch that needs to happen. Maybe you need to just do some little circles with your neck and your head to let some of that habitual tension release even more. Just feeling the way as the sense of ease or softening or relaxation flows a little more strongly, the way that there's more creativity or resource, energy sometimes available. Knowing that we can work with that intentionally, skillfully. In our practice today, we'll be exploring some of the ways that when we move more into this relaxed place of being, that we can also begin to evoke, to cultivate some of the beautiful, uplifting qualities of the heart. And so I want to invite you to just imagine Right there in front of you. Someone, maybe a beloved pet, maybe a person, some being, past, present, who you know really appreciates, cares about you. Could be a dog or cat, a friend. Could be somebody that you knew way back in childhood. And just letting the being that you choose be someone not super complicated, not someone who there's extra baggage with. It could be very simple, right? A coworker that you knew as a young adult who was just, fun to be around, had your back. Nothing too crazy. I'm just imagining them there in front of you. And allowing yourself to see them there, looking into your eyes. Appreciating, caring, maybe smiling at you, really seeing you. Letting yourself rest there. Noticing what it's like to have this dear one really present, really caring. Seeing you through their eyes. Appreciating every part of you, your strengths and your struggles. Noticing what that's like. Really allowing yourself as much as you can to let that care in. It's possible that as you do this, there may be other dear ones who want to show up. A parade of pets or old friends. Maybe even those that you've had small but meaningful moments with. Loving that care in as best you can, letting it land in the mind, the body, the heart. Feeling the way that these dear ones really wish you so much goodness. Really want the best for you. You might feel tenderness, your own appreciation and care for them. It could be nostalgia or poignancy or love. There's no wrong way. And then just seeing, just playing with this possibility. Imagining that for a moment now, you could step into this other being's perspective and turn to yourself, seeing through their eyes. The way that they see your strengths, your goodness. Just noticing what that's like. You can stay here with that recollection, or you can let it go. Resting in the field of this care and just being with a body breathing, the receptive heart. Just noticing what the impact is on the mind and body and heart. When you allow yourself to rest in this kind of field of care. We are wired to care and to be cared about. And often we lose sight of that fact. These practices of turning towards these moments, small. Micro expressions, even of care, let us remember who we really are. Not that part of you that needs to run a bunch of errands or reschedule a doctor's appointment or clean the kitchen later. The part of you that has touched countless lives through big and small actions. The part of you who have been impacted by the care, the connection, laughter of others. Sometimes the deepest expression of who we are can be found in those moments, walking the dog or laughing with a friend, and caring for someone in our life who needs us. Little by little, in these small moments, we begin to remember who we really are. And then, as you're ready, you might stretch a little bit and bringing a little movement back into the body. And then just gently opening your eyes. And before you engage with the screen again, you might just take a little look around the room. Coming back into seeing. And then just turning back into our circle. Thank you for your practice. One of the ways that we can think about these practices of metta and metta adjacent kind of practices. For those of you who aren't familiar with metta, it's the Pali word that very loosely translates to loving kindness or friendliness, some of the qualities that we touched into a little bit here today. One of the ways we can think of these practices are as constructive and cultivating practices. Often in some of the psychological literature, there's kind of three buckets of where we might place different kinds of meditation. Constructive, where we're evoking a certain type of feeling, where we're actually strengthening certain mind states. Deconstructive, where we're actually allowing certain solidified aspects of our experience to dissolve. Things like touching into impermanence, would be an example of something that would be a deconstructive practice. Some of the meditations on the parts of the body, where we're actually taking this sense of the body from this whole solid thing to individual parts and energies. And then attentional, where we're really focusing our attention in a particular direction and strengthening that capacity for attention, for focus, for really being with a particular object of meditation. And truly, the metta practice in some ways touches on all of these things. It is constructive in that we are evoking and cultivating and strengthening a certain type of feeling. It can be deconstructive in that, I don't know about you, but sometimes when we take that step of looking at ourselves through the eyes of someone else, it can actually deconstruct some of the stories and the solidified, kind of calcified ideas we have about ourselves. And then, of course, we're using the attention in a particular way, to point it at some object, some very intentionally using our ability to focus the attention and awareness on something. And, this is important because part of what we're doing here, really at the root of it, is we're training our minds and our hearts. We're inviting ourselves into discovering a different way of using the mind and the heart that can strengthen these qualities, that can actually make appreciation and care and warmth, both giving and receiving, more accessible to us. And, our hearts can hold so much. As we deepen in our practice, we start to see the way that it's possible to become softer, more tender. We start to see some of the ways that the inner critic even can loosen its grip on us. And that's beautiful because this practice invites us to begin to shed layers of armor that have been built up over a lifetime so that we can truly experience what's at the core of our hearts. And of course, one of the tools for this is the metta practice. And one of the traditional ways we practice metta is often envisioning an easy to care about person and sending them kindness, often using phrases, bringing that care to ourself, bringing that care to a neutral person, and so on, expanding outwards. But there are also many ways we can practice metta that engage the imagination and the mind and the body. And the thing with metta, really, I think when people first encounter it, they tend to either love it or hate it. And I would say that oftentimes when we fall in the hate it camp, a lot of the time it's because we've been exposed to maybe a metta practice that didn't quite work for our system, or there was some part of it that was actually hitting up against some aspect of our experience or identity or conditioning that wasn't quite ready for it. If we've been conditioned to be tough and self-sufficient and, not take any crap from anybody because it felt like nobody was going to be there for us, it can be very intense actually to turn towards that metta practice because it can bring up a lot. Often, one of the first layers when we start really concertedly practicing metta over a period of time, often grief can arise. Often grief around the warmth, the kindness, the love that maybe we missed out on, or didn't have for long enough, or didn't feel brave enough to risk, all these different things. But the beautiful thing is that over time, the balance of these ways that metta can feel like more of a purification practice, something that brings up some of the places that show us where it's harder to care, the balance often changes over time. And it becomes more and more and more easy to move through with an open heart, to move through with a lot of care. Yeah. Think about, and some of you have heard this story already, but this was 10 years ago at this point, and I will never forget it because it was such a powerful experience of what metta can actually do to our conditioning. I was on a long retreat at Spirit Rock, and it was a 2-month retreat. I would say we were maybe a couple weeks in, and there was a big flu actually that was just ripping through the retreat, and people were sick. They were coughing. I kind of think the person who was sharing our room, the room next to me, so we shared a wall. I think they might have been patient zero, because they came into the retreat really not doing well, and they had a terrible cough, and they were up throughout the night, coughing so loudly. And every night it would wake me up and I'd have trouble getting back to sleep, and it was hard. You come from a busy life. It was a huge thing for me at that point in my life to get a leave of absence from my job and go sit this retreat and all of that. And something funny happened though. Couple weeks in, we'd been practicing metta quite a lot, every day, and I was bringing it into my walking practice a lot too, because that just works for me to bring metta into walking as well. And all of a sudden, one night, instead of being woken up and my conditioning and my exhaustion from my life outside of the retreat, instead of waking up and being like, oh my gosh, no, I just want to sleep, I rolled over and I started whispering the metta phrases to that wall that we shared. In my sleep, essentially, I was barely awake. This was an unconscious action. But that's what happens, right? When we practice these qualities over and over, we start to build new pathways in the brain that are oriented towards this kind of care. And so all of a sudden, the natural response, the conditioned response that happened when I was barely awake was to care, was to wish her well, was to feel compassion for how hard it must be to be having this really difficult physical time. This is the power of what we're doing. We're rewiring the way that our brains work. It's a big deal. Barbara Fredrickson, who's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina, she actually found through studies that she did there that practicing 7 weeks of metta practice increased for the participants, their feelings of love, joy, contentment, gratitude, pride, hope, interest, amusement, and awe. That sounds like a pretty free heart and mind to be able to feel hope and amusement and awe and gratitude. And this work, the way that we are seeing now in modern neuroscience, what the Buddha knew 2,500 years ago, it just doesn't cease to amaze me. I think it is so cool. What they found was these ancient 2,500-year-old practices that we have the good fortune of stumbling into in whatever way we found ourselves in the Dharma. Metta practices increases our vagal tone. The vagus nerve is a part of the parasympathetic nervous system that actually flows throughout our entire body from our head through our ears, our jaw down. They actually call it the wandering nerve because it goes everywhere down into our gut, into our heart. And it effectively activates the parasympathetic nervous system. It helps create that feeling of rest and digest, that it can increase positive emotion, feeling of social connection, feeling of safety. But she also found through these studies of metta that the metta practice increases the gray matter in our brains in the area of the brain related to emotion regulation. It literally changes the volume of the gray matter in the brain. 7 weeks, this study was. That's not a long time. It improves our stress response and our resilience. One other study actually found that it, particularly in women, delays the biological markers of aging. It decreases the length of our telomeres, these genetic little bits of material that are a biological marker of age. It's really quite an astonishing thing. And the really interesting thing, which I think is very, very important to name, sometimes one of the pushback that we'll see around the metta practice is, the world's a mess right now. Things are hard. We know that. This is a tough time we're in. And so sometimes there'll be a sense of like, well, things are so bad. What help could I possibly be doing by sitting here on a meditation cushion, closing my eyes and just thinking loving thoughts, right? There can be some guilt or maybe a sense of powerless that might come, like, well, am I doing enough? But the really cool thing is that actually one of the things that have been found is that the metta practice primes the brain to respond, and take compassionate action. So when we're doing metta practice, it's actually making us more inclined to care, to help, to be pro-social, to be altruistic. Daniel Goleman and Richard Davidson, in their book Altered Traits, they share simply learning about compassion doesn't increase compassionate behavior. If I were to teach you a class about why does compassion matter? Why is it important? And we weren't going to do any kind of contemplative meditative work to actually put ourselves in a state of mind oriented towards care, we might not change our behavior at all. But if we were to practice metta, practice compassion, work in this way with the nervous system and the mind to feel these caring feelings. That actually takes the arc of empathizing for someone's suffering and turning that into action. That is the link between caring and doing. So this metta practice, what we did in our meditation today, feeling that sense of connection, allowing ourselves to rest in care and being cared for, while, it often feels very good, it's also making an impact on the way we behave. You might practice like that and then go run some errands, and, someone in the line in front of you at the grocery store drops all their change on the floor. That metta practice might be the difference between you helping them pick it up and, maybe giving them some kind words if they're feeling embarrassed, and just standing there not doing anything. This is actually changing the way we behave. They found that compassion and loving kindness, these practices, they actually increase the activation of the amygdala in response to suffering. Rather than just a concentration meditation practice, this actually primes us to have these areas of the brain that want to respond, that want to do something, light up. And it acts quickly. I found that in as little as 8 hours of loving kindness practice, there are reductions in unconscious bias, the kind of unconscious bias that's usually intractable in people. And that bias dissolves even more and even more after about 16 hours. That when we practice loving kindness, we can actually undo conditioning of prejudice, of ableism, of judgment. That's pretty astonishing to me. And the longer people practice, the stronger these tendencies get. The more metta we do, the more our behavior towards care and co towards compassion strengthens. And, one of the beautiful things that the people who study this point to is that the fact that this happens so easily over just like 8 to 16 hours, that we can shift so much, that it may be an indicator of our biological preparedness for goodness, that we are innately wired to be caring. It's beautiful. And of course, this is something that the Buddha's been talking about for thousands of years before any scientist in a white jacket put someone in an MRI machine and said, "Hey, I wonder what happens when we look at your brain while you meditate." In the Anguttara Nikaya Metta Sutta, the Buddha says, monks, for one whose awareness release, so their awakening, through goodwill is cultivated, developed, pursued, handed the reins and taken as a basis. So basically, when you are waking up through care, through compassion, and you are just wholeheartedly giving your practice over to that, 11 benefits can be expected. And so he says, which 11? He says, one, sleeps easily, wakes easily, dreams no evil dreams. One is dear to human beings, dear to non-human beings. The devas, the spirits of the land, protect one. Neither fire nor poison nor weapons can touch one. One's mind gains concentration quickly. One's complexion is bright. One dies unconfused. And if penetrating no higher, is headed for the Brahma worlds. So a certain level of existence that is less innately filled with suffering. And he says these are the 11 benefits that can be expected for one whose awakening, awareness, release through goodwill is cultivated, developed, pursued, handed the reins, taken as a basis, given a grounding, steadied, consolidated, and well undertaken. And this is a tall order to be impervious to fire or poison, but at the same time, I think about my own experience. One. He says, one sleeps easily, wakes easily, and dreams no evil dreams. You roll over in the middle of the night and you care instead of feel annoyed. That's the basis for some better sleep, I'll tell you. So I'm breaking some of this down. Practicing metta, it makes us more prone to helping others, but it also primes something in us. It primes our power to care. And if you go by the Buddhist texts, this clarity of mind and heart that comes with it has far-reaching impact in this lifetime and beyond. It's a absolute onward leading factor towards awakening. And I love this because all of this is put together telling us that the metta practice, that really allowing ourselves to cultivate these qualities of the heart that care, is acting on these many different levels and layers. It's actually supporting our own health, our nervous system, the heart itself. But it's also empowering us to notice and act on our own capacity for kindness. It can strengthen our spiritual resolve. It can boost our mindfulness, can help us move through life with a clear head and a clear heart. It's so far from the stereotype that someone might have who isn't as familiar with the power of these practices. We're not just sitting on the cushion trying to feel loving Because it's nice. It is nice. But we're doing something. We're actually doing something quite big, quite significant. We're strengthening our hearts and we're strengthening all of the behaviors and conditioning that are primed to act with a more open heart. Nelson Mandela says, "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite." And again, this is that biological preparedness for goodness, that there is something hardwired in our very being that can attune to kindness, that can offer care, that can have these pro-social tendencies. The metta practice is not just a personal practice. We're not just doing it to feel good or to relax. There's no universe truly in which your metta practice doesn't ripple out into the world. Because you're in the world, right? You're talking to people, you're going to work, you're being with your family, you're getting stuck in rush hour traffic and having to change lanes. And all of these moments, we are presented over and over and over again with choice points. Do we respond with care and compassion, or do we not? This is like a gym for our brains. We're doing reps. We're learning how to respond more and more and more and more often with that kindness, with that goodness, with offering to help ourselves, people around us, the world. Because your words and your actions and your very day-to-day habits have impact, right? That person that we have a friendly chat with in line, at a coffee shop or the DMV or, wherever it is, can change their day. I know I've certainly had moments where, a really simple interaction with a stranger has completely shifted the valence of the rest of my day, for better or for worse, right? We've had those moments, probably each one of us, where someone's rude to us and it just oof, can be crushing, right? Just as much as those moments when someone smiles or, makes a little joke or compliments our shirt, whatever it is, it's suddenly, oh, wow, the world looks a little better in this moment. I don't feel quite so at odds with the universe around me. Each one of us has that power in just these very small moments. We are so attuned to other people, just the way that we're wired, that we're constantly picking up on those micro expressions. Some of these things are so subtle and they just happen in body language. It doesn't even have to be a true interaction with someone. You've probably met those people where they walk into a room and it's like, oh, wow, it just feels nice to be around them. Yeah. Can really help. Because it's not just about that one interaction, right? Like metta practice, it's about many interactions repeated over time. And this is really one of, I think, the most important things about our meditation practice in general. We may not have a huge awakening experience from 1 hour of meditation or one retreat. We might. But a lot of the time, it really is about this sort of steady, consistent building. We're dipping into a particular state of mind and heart. We're strengthening our capacity to respond, to engage in that way. And then we're dipping back out into our life. And we're flowing between these things so that over time they actually start to become closer and closer together, more part of the fabric of our world. And it all adds up, right? Ripples outward. It builds more trust. It builds a greater sense of community, a greater sense of well-being. Safety. The more we do it, the greater an impact it'll have. And most likely it'll also feel kind of nice a lot of the time that we're doing it, which is a great bonus. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem that a lot of people in the Dharma scene share over the years. So it may be familiar to you, but part of the reason that I love this poem, aside from the fact that it's quite beautiful, is actually the story behind it is very incredible. And it points to these moments of very simple kindness, when someone goes out of their way, just a little bit to care. This is from Naomi Shihab Nye. The story behind this poem, Kindness, is actually that the poet had just gotten married the week before. And she and her new husband, they had plans as their honeymoon to actually travel in South America for 3 months. And they were just at the very, very start of this trip, you know, first couple of days. They were on a bus at the very beginning of the trip, and someone came into the bus armed and robbed them and the other people on the bus of everything, their cash, their passports, their credit cards. And someone else on the bus was actually killed, the Indian that she refers to in the poem. And the way that she shares about this, she shared that when they got off the bus, she was sitting in the town square. When they reached a destination, not even, I don't think the destination they were planning to go, but they had to get somewhere. And her husband were sitting there in the square. They were trying to figure out what to do. And a man came up to them on the street because he could tell that they were in distress. And he was just kind to them. Nothing crazy. He just showed up and he asked them what happened and he listened and he cared. And her husband went to hitchhike to another city so that he could get their traveler's checks reinstated and get some help. And this was really quite scary, that fear of splitting up after such a trauma had happened, not knowing when he'd return, not having cell phones. And the story goes that after this experience of kindness with a stranger who approached them, she sat there in the plaza and it was as if a voice came to her and it spoke this entire poem. And the poem goes like this. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. All this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in the white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know, kindness has the deepest thing inside. You must know that sorrow has the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it's only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It's you I've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere. like a shadow or a friend. We are inviting kindness to be that shadow, that friend. Through these practices, through feeling the thread of the sorrow that they may sometimes catch, through being able to be that person in the square offering kindness to someone else. Each step of the way, we're letting kindness more and more fully into our lives. And so we'll stop here. And I really thank you for your kind attention.
Please consider supporting Dharma Seed with a year-end gift. Your donations allow us to offer these teachings online to all. Visit dharmaseed.org/donate to learn more. And thanks.